Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
You're listening to New Books in Geography, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host for today, Stentor Danielson, from the Department of Geography, Geology, and the Environment at Slippery Rock University. Today, I'll be talking to Abigail Perkis, author of Hurricane Sandy on New Jersey's Forgotten Shore, published this year by Cornell University Press. Dr. Perkis, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
To start off, why don't you tell our listeners a bit about your background and how you came to write this book?
Sure. Yeah, I'm an associate professor of history at Kane University in Union, New Jersey. And Kane was immediately affected by Hurricane Sandy when it hit the New Jersey coastline in 2012. A number of our students, their homes were catastrophically damaged by the storm. Our infrastructure at the university was likewise damaged. The school was closed for about 2 weeks. So I came back to campus after we reopened, recognizing that something really significant had just happened. And just a couple weeks later, I got a phone call from a good friend of mine who at the time was the assistant historian at the Senate and also on the board of the Regional Oral History Association, Oral History in the Mid-Atlantic region, who asked me if I knew of anybody doing oral history work around the storm in the New Jersey area. And I was at the time kind of wrapping up my first book project and had done a number of oral history interviews for that project, but hadn't ever been formally trained in doing a large scale oral history project. And I said to her, you know, I don't know anyone doing it, but as it happens, this sounds like a really neat opportunity to think about doing this work in a more intentional way. The Regional Oral History Association was offering their support in terms of expertise, in terms of kind of person power. And I loved the idea of getting involved in something like that at the beginning. And so I walked into my department chair's office and I said, what do you think about this? How might we do it? And he said, I love it. Let's do it in the classroom in January. And this was probably late November 2012. So, you know, all of our students had already registered for classes. They were getting ready for finals. And within a week, we had the university backing. We had funding for recorders. We had a relationship with Oral History in the Mid-Atlantic region for students to present at their spring concert. And we had started advertising this course. So this kind of ball started rolling and a project was born without any of us actually realizing that we were creating something that ultimately would be bigger than the sum of its individual parts.
It's great when everything just comes together like that.
Yeah, I still look back on it. We're nearly a decade to the anniversary of the storm. And we certainly didn't go into this project with the expectation that I would write a book afterward. It started as a class exercise, and it just grew in ways that felt really significant, even in the moment. I think we realized that the students really realized that they were becoming a part of something that would have a history of itself, right? That they were creating a database, essentially. They were creating a set of primary sources, and they really took responsibility for that. And took a deep sense of onus in in doing that work. And I think because of that, it just became this self-perpetuating engine.
Yeah, so as you mentioned, we're recording this just, I guess, a little over a month shy of the 10-year anniversary of Hurricane Sandy hitting New Jersey. So before we get into the details of what's in your book, maybe you can just refresh all of our memories, give us the big picture context of what Hurricane Sandy was.
Yeah, I get so in the weeds of the project that I forget that, you know, in most people's lives, it was just, I hate to say it this way, but just another hurricane that hit the United States that year. For the folks that live in New Jersey, it was obviously so much more. Hurricane Sandy was, at the time, one of the largest storms to ever hit the eastern seaboard. And unlike Florida or the Caribbean, it happened in a place that just isn't built for catastrophic storm damage. Residents are not used to hurricane preparations. You know, they get wind, they get rain, but they never see the kind of destruction that a storm like Sandy wrought. And I think because of that, people had a really hard time conceptualizing how to prepare for that. So I live in Philadelphia. I live about 2 hours from campus and an hour and a half from the Jersey Shore. And I went to bed the night that the storm hit without power, but woke up and power came back on within, I don't know, 5 or 6 hours of when we woke up. And I spent the next couple weeks actually sitting at a coffee shop doing page proofs for the book that I was publishing at the time, not fully appreciating what had taken place at the shore. And we were seeing images of New York City, of Manhattan, of Queens, of Atlantic City, you know, the more kind of focal areas of the media attention. And it was devastating. But we were not seeing necessarily the full expanse of the damage in New Jersey, and specifically in some of the smaller, less touristed areas that kind of exist between Staten Island and the what we call the Bay Shore, the Raritan and Sandy Hook Bays in kind of northeastern New Jersey.
Yeah, so I guess it's good to clarify the forgotten shore that's referenced in your title is that stretch kind of facing towards New York City from the south, from the Raritan to Sandy Hook, is the area that you're really focusing on.
Exactly.
And why is it called the Forgotten Shore?
When my students and I said, and I apologize, I know I'm bouncing back and forth between this oral history project and the book itself, and they're so intertwined because the book really is a narrative history drawn from the oral history interviews that we collected from 2013 to 2016. When we set out to collect these interviews, we started to think about what stories we wanted to tell. And we gravitated toward the Bay Shore, not because we thought that it was the hardest hit area, but in fact, because two of the six students who signed up for the class were living there and had experienced that destruction firsthand. And so we realized, you know, there was a bit of an opportunity there to make connections in these communities and for folks to be able to tell their stories, because those stories weren't necessarily being picked up by, you know, on the airwaves and by the media attention. And I don't think we thought about it as a forgotten shore in that moment, and not until we started to collect interviews. And we collected close to 80 interviews all told, did we realize the impact of the attention on the, like, capital J, capital S Jersey Shore, on the folks that were living off of the Atlantic coast, off of that shore, in terms of feeling like they were getting kind of marginalized, right? That they were really feeling forgotten, you know, victimized by the storm and then victimized by the inattention that followed.
Yeah. And then to pick up on what you had said earlier about, you know, this is an area that doesn't experience hurricanes regularly, like Florida does. But in fact, you even mentioned that they had experienced a hurricane just the previous year, Hurricane Irene, and it went so well that people kind of downplayed the danger when Sandy was approaching, because they're like, oh, we already had one of these. It worked out fine.
Yeah. Hurricane Irene, and I apologize, I forget who said this, but was referred to at the time as a governmental wolf cry. right? People got so worried about Irene in August of 2011 and prepared so well. And then, in fact, the storm kind of lost luster as it made its way up the coast and caused damage, but nothing to the extent that Sandy ultimately did, that they kind of poo-pooed what was coming next and said, you know, we've heard these warnings before, and it's not going to be that big a deal. So maybe we'll sit this one out.
Yeah, and so then connecting to what you've said about this is growing out of an oral history project. You describe the book in your preface with this great phrase. You call it an intimate window. So can you talk a bit about, you know, what that means about your approach to telling this story of what happened during this hurricane?
Absolutely. I think that when we hear about storms, when we encounter these stories as an American public, right, we hear the acute moment that they, you know, they make landfall. We see that immediate destruction. And then because we live in this, you know, incredibly fast news cycle, it kind of fades from our attention. And what we set out to do here was kind of bridge that gap, to tell the stories of the storm, not just in the immediate aftermath, not just what happened that day and the day after, but really in the months and ultimately the years that followed, not from a bird's eye policy view, but from the experience of the folks that lived the storm and also lived the recovery that followed. So we weren't looking at big picture analyses. We weren't looking at broad economic numbers. We really wanted those individual human stories. And we wanted not just to capture them, you know, in an immediate sense, but also to figure out a way to chronicle, to catalog and archive them, so that those stories would live on as part of the long memory of Hurricane Sandy for future scholars and practitioners and advocates and government officials to draw from in developing new toolkits for how to deal with the catastrophic storms that are, you know, only growing in both ferocity and frequency as we deal with climate change.
And one of the things that approach helps you get at is some of the emotions that people were having both during the storm and then in the aftermath and the rebuilding phase and so forth. So can you talk a bit about some of the emotional reactions that people had?
To the storm, you mean? To the experience?
The storm and then in the rebuilding phase.
Yeah, I think what I was most struck by were the small moments, right? Not the, oh my gosh, I'm having to swim down the street to get rescued, which we certainly heard those stories, but the moments where people just realized that their lives had profoundly shifted. You know, the woman who stocked up on canned food because she knew that her power would go out, but didn't think about the fact that she had an electric can opener. And so she had no means of opening those cans. The couple where, you know, they were quite elderly and they were thinking about, well, how are we going to get out of our house? And he said, okay, I've got my axe. I'm ready. We can break a hole in the ceiling. And then he realized that he wouldn't have the strength to do that and to lift them both out. And so they sat down on the bed just quietly and kind of waited for the storm to do what it was going to do. And ultimately, you know, we interviewed both of them. They both were okay. But it was those moments of kind of recognition of the power of what was happening that didn't cause a cacophony, right? That were private, that were quiet, that nobody ever would have heard about if not for people giving us their stories, you know, people trusting us to take care of their stories.
Yeah, the moment that you mentioned there where the couple is like sitting on their bed watching as the water comes up their stairs towards the second floor and there's nowhere that they can go, that was just like, ugh. You know, you could almost see that on like a television show or something, but it was real. It actually happened, and they, you know, survived. I think they said that it got like up to the second floor and then receded again.
Yeah. And we heard so many of those stories, you know, this moment of, oh, it's going to get me. Oh, it's coming so close. And then really quietly, right, the water just started to recede. And I think for many of the folks that we interviewed, there was this several hour period of, okay, did that actually just happen? I mean, obviously they registered that it happened, but that was such an underwhelming, you know, retreat. And it wasn't until they woke up the next day and went outside and looked around and they kind of took in how profound those moments actually were.
And then another moment that illustrated another interesting side of the recovery process was the Christmas tree, the hope tree, that one of the people set up. Can you tell us the story of the hope tree?
Yeah. Jim Butler was somebody whose parents lived right in Union Beach, and their house was washed away in the storm. And he had been going back to the community to help with the cleanup for a number of weeks and came across this old artificial Christmas tree that, you know, that had washed up. And kind of on a whim, he decided to set it up on a street corner. And appropriately, it was the corner of Jersey Lane and Shore Avenue, I believe. So Jersey and Shore. And somebody came that night and put an ornament on it. And it kind of became this, it just took on this life of its own. Jim, you know, under cover of night would go back and, you know, put out all these ornaments, arrange these ornaments. And then he started to get donations, and he would give these donations anonymously to people in the community to, you know, to go to Home Depot and get the lumber that they needed, or to go and get their kids' Christmas presents. And it became really a lifeblood of the neighborhood and ultimately of the state. It was featured on many news outlets, featured it on TV. My students and I developed an exhibit at the Tuckered and Siemens and Baymans Museum down in South Jersey, and they actually shipped the Hope Tree down so it could be part of the exhibit. And it continues to stand. It's on kind of a permanent structure. It continues to stand at that same corner, you know, almost 10 years later. It was actually one of the most fun parts of the book to write, because I reconstructed so much of Jim's thought processes and actions through his Facebook pages. You know, he and I, we had interviewed him, and he gave me access to his Facebook content. You know, we friended each other on Facebook. And so I was able to go back to 2012 and literally, like, minute by minute, hour by hour, read his real-time thoughts and then capture that for the book. So it was a different kind of research than I had ever done, but it was also just, it was really fun to write, to kind of tell that story as it was playing out.
I'm glad to hear that the tree is still there, because I actually went and looked it up on Facebook after I read that section, and the official Facebook page hasn't been updated in a couple of years, so I'm glad to know it's still going.
Yeah.
But that's a good segue into another thing I wanted to ask about, which was the role of social media. You know, how did things like Facebook make Sandy different from, you know, other storms that came before the era of social media?
That's a great question. And it wasn't something I think we expected to encounter when we went into these interviews. You know, power went out all over the region. And so people had their phones, but they didn't have their televisions. They didn't necessarily have radios. Facebook in particular, that was the social media platform that was most prevalent at the time, became a way for people to communicate with each other. So towns set up pages specifically to communicate information about the storm. People posted photos that night saying, okay, we're here. Like, you know, they now have the check this box if you're safe, and we will broadcast that out over social media. That was what people were doing organically during the storm. And then people were creating, you know, de facto clothing drives and food drives and posting, okay, so here I went to this corner and I was able to get a new pair of shoes, or this corner doesn't have any gas lines and they still have stock. And people were really using it as a networking platform.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
So then one of the policy dimensions that you bring up is that New Jersey has this home rule law that gives local governments a lot of autonomy. How did that play into the response to Sandy?
It's an interesting question. And I don't know, it was hard for me to separate out the real answer to that question from the perception. A number of folks that we interviewed perceived home rule to be a real impediment to a broader network of support. And essentially what the home rule charter does is it creates autonomous kind of municipal entities throughout the state so that every city, every township, every kind of municipal government has its own autonomy to create police forces and trash service and all of these things that in other cities and in other states get consolidated based on population. In New Jersey, it's just much more kind of siloed. And some folks felt like because of that, it was really inefficient to create support networks and to do broad scale rehabilitation after the storm. When I looked at some of the scholars that were digging into that, they seemed to indicate that that may not have actually been true, that the recovery wasn't hampered by home rule, but it remains true that people felt that. And I think so much of the recovery process is about the lived experience rather than, you know, what's actually happening at the state level. Those two things are equally important to people's impressions of what's going on.
Yeah, and so going up to the state level, the governor at the time, Chris Christie, shows up a lot in the book. So how did people in this area of New Jersey feel about Chris Christie and his handling of the storm?
Yeah, I think Sandy really put Chris Christie on the map in a national way. And he was really seen as he's a Republican governor of a blue state. The area that we were documenting leans red. So he had a fair bit of, he had a disproportionate amount of support on the Bayshore relative to the rest of the state. And he was pretty popular across the state, despite it being, you know, leaning blue. And Sandy just gave him, he became this media darling. And he did so because he really said, you know, forget about politics, forget about Democrats versus Republicans, forget about the upcoming presidential election. Like, we need to focus on what's going on here, and I need to make sure I'm getting stuff done for my constituents. And he did this, you know, right before the 2012 election between Obama and Mitt Romney. And a lot of people in the Republican Party got really upset that he would kind of jeopardize those political relationships, jeopardize Romney's chances in the state for you know, this bigger picture. And he had this really significant rise. And then it started to unravel. And I think you know, if you ask the folks on the Bay Shore, it started to unravel not in the months after the storm, but in the years after the storm with unmet promises and people feeling like he had kind of staked his claim on making sure that every single person felt heard and supported. And ultimately, many people on the Bay Shore felt like his attention was redirected toward the Atlantic coastline, toward the tourism industry, at the expense of the year-round residents.
Yeah, I remember seeing his kind of rise and fall in the media through the storm and then some of the scandals that came up afterwards.
Yeah, and obviously there's a much bigger context to that, a political context, an economic context, a national political context. But for the folks living on the Bay Shore, so much of their perception of him was wrapped up in the Sandy response, both good and bad.
Yeah. So I want to circle back around now to the oral history project that provided kind of the base for this, that started with that class that you did just the semester after it. And you said, I think, 80 interviews that you ultimately did. So what were some of the major challenges and like opportunities, cool things that happened during the course of that oral history project?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I have such a hard time separating out the project from the book, in part because I'm so proud of the work my students did and so proud of how much they stepped into this pretty uncomfortable role. None of them had any background in oral history. Five of them were history majors. One was an English major. And they all just kind of took this leap of faith with me, right? I said to them, this is not something that I have done before. This is not something that our university has done before. Let's create something together. And they bought into that. And they went and kind of created something that they wanted. So every step of the way, right? Like from the title of the project, we spent an entire 4 hours coming up with the title of the project, which was Staring Out to Sea, largely because one of the students really liked the alliteration. They went to community meetings in towns along the Bay Shore to recruit narrators and to tell people that this project was happening. They traveled to Washington, D.C. and to Oklahoma City to present at academic conferences. And they really reimagined how they saw themselves through this project. You talk to them now, and they still, 10 years later, a number of them will point to this project as a pivotal moment of their academic and professional careers. One student went on to do disaster relief work through kind of, I can't remember the name of the program, but it's kind of the corollary to AmeriCorps, specifically with disaster relief. Another one thought very seriously about going to get a master's in oral history and ultimately ended up kind of integrating some of that work into her secondary teaching. A third became a public interest lawyer and really says that this project gave him a different orientation toward the type of law he wanted to practice. And that's all because of what they put into it. Like I continue to be amazed by the work that they did. And as you say, it was not without challenges. You know, trying to do a multi-year project on a semester system meant that once that one semester ended, the students had to stay involved either out of the goodness of their heart or because, you know, through internship credit, through independent study, and then they graduated. And we tried to maintain some momentum with it, but it was much more in fits and starts at that point. With a few other students coming on and collecting interviews or re-interviewing folks after we had interviewed them the first time. Funding was a really big challenge, you know, sustaining that momentum over a number of years. Lack of skills, really. Like, I was learning this as I went as well, and so I had a pretty good handle on the oral history arm of it, but some of the digital humanities pieces, you know, I felt like a fish out of water there. And ultimately, we were able to partner with another university in South Jersey, and a class down there that was specifically focused on digital humanities kind of took up the presentation arm of the project. So opportunities came out of those challenges, but it was not just a an easy road from start to completion.
Okay, so this is a relatively slim book, so I don't want to give too many spoilers and discourage people from going out and picking it up themselves. So I want to now sort of move in towards the wrap up to our interview by asking you first, is there anyone that you'd like to give a shout out or a thank you to whose help was important to you as you were writing the book?
Absolutely. Both in the creation of the project and the writing of the book, Kate Scott down in the Senate, Dan Royals, who at the time was the professor at Stockton University where we did the digital humanities arm, Doug Boyd at the Kentucky, the Louis B. Nunn Center for Oral History at the University of Kentucky, where the interviews are now housed. All of them were kind of instrumental in helping drive the project forward. And the students, I'm worried about naming them because I'm terrified I'm going to forget somebody, but let me try to do this without having a list in front of me. Mary Pisecki, Alicia Hill, Brittany Lestrange, Arj Syed, Abdulfat Rashid, and Trudy Lawrence were the six original students in the project, and they ended up being interviewed for the project as well. So we have their own oral histories as part of the collection. So their experience lives on as well.
And then the final question, we always like to end by asking what you're working on next.
Yeah, I just started a new project, which I'm super excited about, actually. It blends the work I've been doing in recent years on oral history with what I, studied as a grad student and beyond. And so I'm writing about the MOVE bombing in Philadelphia, which took place in 1985 when the city's mayor authorized the police department to drop 2 tons of explosives on the residential home and headquarters of a group called MOVE, which espoused the politics of Black power and prioritized the kind of intrinsic value of all living things, kind of radical environmentalism. And there's a very long history to the incident itself, to the relationship between MOVE and the city. But what I'm actually writing about is the journalists that covered the bombing over the course of the week that it took place, kind of how they crafted the story, what editorial decisions they made, how did they curate this collective understanding and ultimately a collective memory of that day, which lives on in incredibly complicated ways, both in the city and in the country.
Okay, well, we'll look forward to seeing that. And so thank you so much for coming on the show.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me.
This has been a conversation with Abigail Perkis, author of Hurricane Sandy on New Jersey's Forgotten Shore, published this year by Cornell University Press.
Thank you.